It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On Monday, the EPA released a strategic roadmap to address PFAS chemicals, known as forever chemicals. These human-made chemicals don't break down naturally and can end up in water supplies. Christina Maruzic is a reporter with Environmental Health News who has reported on these chemicals. Christina, welcome back to the Confluence.
Hi, Kevin. It's great to be here again.
So, briefly, what are PFAS chemicals? We're hearing more and more about them, but what are they?
PFAS is short for perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, and that's a class of chemicals that includes more than 5,000 individual chemicals that all have similar properties. And they're used in non-stick and waterproof coatings on all kinds of things, everything from pots and pans to clothing, takeout food, wrappers and boxes, carpeting, furniture, and they're also used in a firefighting foam that's commonly used by airports and the military.
What kinds of health issues have they been linked to?
So exposure to PFAS has been linked to testicular and kidney cancers, decreased birth weights, thyroid disease, high cholesterol, pregnancy-induced hypertension, asthma, and ulcerative colitis.
These chemicals, have they been found in drinking water in the Pittsburgh region?
They have, yeah. So the Department of Environmental Protection, the Pennsylvania State Department of Environmental Protection, tested around 400 sites throughout the state where it thought there could have been contamination for certain PFAS chemicals. In the initial round of sampling in 2019, they found contamination in Coriopolis near the Pittsburgh airport. We've had some other issues with contamination locally. There was recently a problem in McKeesport where firefighting foam was accidentally shot back into a fire hydrant when firefighters were putting out a fire at a local business. And they had to tell people not to drink or use the water there. So some residents of McKeesport didn't have water to drink or cook with or even bathe in for a month. So when that happened, a local environmental advocacy group, Women for a Healthy Environment, called for a statewide ban on the firefighting foam. Some safer alternatives exist now, and a few other states have already started switching over.
Pennsylvania's Environmental Quality Board voted in June to set a maximum contaminant level for these substances. Do we know what that contaminant level is for these substances?
So the Department of Environmental Protection has been promising to regulate PFAS chemicals in Pennsylvania drinking water since 2017. So as you mentioned in June, the Environmental Quality Board at Department of Environmental Protection voted to set drinking water limit for PFOA, which stands for perfluorooctanoic acid, and also PFOS, PFOS. That's another kind of widespread and known to be very harmful PFOS chemical. But they rejected the recommendations that the Delaware Riverkeeper Network had submitted for a PFOA limit between 1 part per trillion and 6 part per trillion, saying that further studies are needed. And other states that have set a limit for PFOA are generally in the range of 5 to 15 parts per trillion.
So do we have a full picture of the contamination from these chemicals across the state? You gave us some examples, Coriopolis and McKeesport, but across the state, do we have a full picture of it?
We have a partial picture of it. So the DEP tested around 400 sites throughout the state where they thought there might be contamination. They put out a report on that testing this past June, and the report said that widespread contamination wasn't a problem. But they only flagged locations with combined PFAS levels above the current EPA health advisory level of 70 parts per trillion. And a lot of health officials have said that number is much too high, which is why, as you mentioned, on Monday, the EPA has come out and said they plan to revise that number. That number is also not legally enforceable right now. It's just a recommended limit.
You mentioned that the EPA federal roadmap, not really enforceable. So what possible impact could it have here in Pennsylvania?
The new plan that the EPA published on Monday includes an updated and accelerated timeline for various steps to regulate and remediate and conduct research on PFAS. So they committed to designating two of the best known chemicals in the class that I've already mentioned, PFOA and PFOS, as hazardous under the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act by the summer of 2023. And if they meet that timeline, that would change the way that these chemicals are manufactured and the way that disposal is regulated, and it might allow for quicker cleanup that was federally funded if contamination was found. And by fall of 2023, EPA said they plan to set enforceable drinking water limits on those same two compounds, which again would compel like local water authorities to spend the money required to filter them out of drinking water. And they also pledged to finalize a risk assessment for those two chemicals in biosolids, which are another way that PFAS gets into food and groundwater. But a lot of environmental groups are concerned that that plan isn't concrete enough and isn't fast enough and doesn't go far enough to protect people. So a couple examples, a group, the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, called it future promises of planning to plan, and said that looking at just one or two of these chemicals at a time when there are, you know, 5,000 of them is a whack-a-mole approach, and that they should instead look at regulating these chemicals at a as a whole class, which is something that EPA has done for other classes of harmful chemicals in the past. And Robert Billet, who's an attorney who sued DuPont on behalf of about 80,000 people who were poisoned by PFAS in West Virginia, he was played by Mark Ruffalo in the 2019 movie Dark Waters about all of this. He came out in a statement about these new EPA rules and said he first urged EPA to regulate PFOA in 2001, and it's very frustrating that 20 years later they're still announcing plans to do it in the future instead of actually doing it.
And Christina, specifically, what about Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, that timeline is actually a little faster than the timeline that state officials have given for, you know, the state setting drinking water regulations for these chemicals. If that timeline that EPA has set forth holds, it's likely that Pennsylvania would just adopt the federal guidelines for those two PFAS chemicals. They may still opt to set drinking water limits for additional chemicals in the class based on some of the specific problems we have here in the state with other chemicals, or they would have the option of adopting more stringent standards than EPA puts forth.
Christina Marusik is a reporter with Environmental Health News. Thanks so much, Christina.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, a coalition of health groups, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and the Children's Hospital Association, declared a national state of emergency in child and adolescent mental health. That same day, the Biden administration announced updated guidance and resources to help schools support childhood and adolescent mental health. Tammy Hughes is a professor in Duquesne University School of Education, Counseling, Psychology, and Special Education, and past president of Trainers of School Psychologists. Welcome back to The Confluence.
Good to see you.
Tammy, do you agree there is a state of emergency when it comes to children's mental health?
I do. We have been seeing an increase in children's mental health needs for the last couple of years. And subsequent to the pandemic, we've actually seen a spike.
Education Secretary Miguel Cardona cited the ongoing impact of the pandemic for the change, for these resources. So is the emergency a result of the pandemic? Was it exacerbated by the pandemic? Was it growing pre-pandemic?
It was growing pre-pandemic. The pandemic certainly exacerbated the problem. Children thrive in systems, your family system, but also the school system and peers, and not having access to their typical systems had a very negative effect on their health and mental health.
What role do schools, educational institutions, counselors, teachers have to play in identifying and addressing what experts are calling this mental health crisis?
One is schools very effectively have social emotional curriculum to help kids grow not only academically, but in their relationships. These sorts of services are what we call prevention services, universal services. They're for everybody in a building. Then we have services for kids that are needing a little bit of extra help. Sometimes we call these tier two services. And then we have services from schools for kids who are placed in specialized program like special education or other things like that. Most mental health services children receive occur at school.
Are there enough of these counselors, school psychologists on board at any school district? And can they be overwhelmed if the numbers of kids that are needing help keep increasing?
So no, there's not enough. There's not enough workforce. And in fact, some of the legislation from the Biden administration is about workforce development. When we look at the national average, it's usually 8 years on average from when a kid is having symptoms to when they actually receive services. This is problematic for several reasons. Obviously, you want to nip things in the bud early as quickly as possible. But the problem is, yes, systems can be overwhelmed. And also sort of our traditional ways we think about teacher referral, parent referral, people sometimes like to wait and see kind of how kids are doing rather than strike while the iron is hot.
Is that wait and see always troublesome, though?
The short story is it's easier to fix a small problem than it is to fix a big problem. Sometimes when it comes to social emotional development or mental health, folks, feel stigmatized by that. And so they tend to wait too long.
Because they fear their child might get stigmatized?
They fear their child might be stigmatized. They fear they might be stigmatized, the family itself. You know, one of the silver linings of the pandemic is that kids are reporting more discussions about mental health needs and mental health services. And the truth is our kids take cues from adults. It's usually the adults that feel stigmatized and not the kids. The kids are like, I'm having a problem. Somebody needs to help me immediately.
How are your colleagues, your counterparts, the folks in your field adapting to this increased need? What is your role in helping these schools, helping these staffers?
So I think the biggest change is the need for services for kids we didn't see coming. When we look at the data, we see kids who had pre-existing mental health problems continue to have mental health problems and have more exacerbated challenges. However, kids that are children of color, kids that are from families that are having economic instability or food insecurity, those guys, those groups are all showing up. But we may not be aware of who is having economic insecurity or who is having food insecurity. That may not be on the radar of the school. And so there's this sort of extra groups that are showing up. My students serve in practicum counseling services in schools all across Allegheny County, and we've just seen a dramatic increase in the demand for services. And schools have stepped up.
Mm-hmm. Are there some ways that you think, in general, schools could have made a more gentle reentry for students?
As a general rule, I think schools are doing the very best they can. Having said that, I'll say the more secure the adults feel and act, the better reentry children have. So, we've seen a lot of kind of up and down activities in the news where parents are very upset and teachers are very upset. And all of these things spill over into children's lives. Reentry really, I would say, needs to be about helping the adults find themselves settled in how they're going to help kids come back.
Tammy, what is trauma-informed care and how can it be used in school? Because for some children, that pandemic has been a traumatic event.
So trauma-informed care is sort of an umbrella term that we use to think about in schools, trauma-informed teaching or trauma-informed instruction. And what that's really about is understanding the experiences kids have and how that impacts their ability to benefit from the educational environment. when we're talking about instruction being trauma-informed, what we're saying is the two primary things that have to happen before we get over into math, science, reading, is making sure people feel safe. We've just talked about physical and psychological safety, and that they have trusted adults that they can depend on when they might need a little extra support. And as you prioritize those things, what we're helping teachers and administrators to do is help kids sort of move through that process so we can get back to instruction quicker. And that actually the state and Department of Public Welfare and PDE have prioritized trauma-informed care.
You told us last year that you were confident that children would bounce back from any learning loss. But how difficult is it to bounce back from these mental health challenges?
I will say kids are resilient. And the amazing thing about kids is they will bounce back. Having said that, I think we should not be rigid in our expectations. You know, you're a fourth grader. Here's how fourth graders act. This is what fourth graders know. I don't really see any evidence of that out in the schools. I see teachers actually really understanding. But to the extent that we can say, you know, here's what you did learn, and here's how we can help you get to the next place. And, you know, learning is a sort of a sequential event, and we know what came before and we know what's coming next. So we're going to get there, and we'll get there together.
Tammy Hughes is a professor in Duquesne University's School of Education, Counseling, Psychology, and Special Education. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. People who live in Pittsburgh's East Hills neighborhood still use the Singer Place steps to get around, but it's one of dozens of illegal dump sites identified by the nonprofit Allegheny Cleanways. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsoppel tagged along one Saturday with its Dump Busters crew of volunteers as they tackled mounds of trash on the hillside.
The cleanup starts when a truck pulls up to deposit a small dumpster at the top of the stairs. Other equipment includes large plastic trash cans and lots of gloves. Danny Kramer, land-based program coordinator, goes over the safety rules with a new volunteer as people arrive.
So the first rule of Dump Busters is you're not allowed to get hurt. The most common injury is stepping on a nail or stepping on something sharp. Any closed containers of liquid, keep them closed. Don't dump them out. It's probably something nasty or dangerous. So we just fill the cans with trash. We weigh the cans on a scale, and we write down the weight on a notebook that I've got over there somewhere. And then we just dump it.
Into the dumpster. Volunteer Lisa Goldstein grabs a can and immediately starts to fill it, but she's a little grossed out by the trash and the worms.
I picked up a dirty diaper. I saw it, I confronted it, and I made peace with it. Honestly, this is the first time I've ever really done something of this, I want to say, for lack of a better term, magnitude. So, it's just, for me personally, it's a big deal.
I think it's good to have this kind of response.
That's Hillary Steffes, who works part-time with Dump Busters. Her overalls are already muddy as she climbs the steps with a heavy black plastic bag.
Shingles are very popular. Like renovation debris. It's just heavy. And so when you're doing renovation, if you are renting a dumpster, the weight does matter and affects the price. So we get a lot of like bags of plaster. Sometimes it's just concrete.
The household trash is a little more perplexing. You know, when you see a littered area, you're more likely to add litter to it. I think that's how this much household trash ends up here. One person misses garbage day and chucks it, and it just kind of adds up after that. And this stuff's been building up for years.
I don't want to ask too many negative questions, but I was going to ask if you ever feel overwhelmed by all of this, because you see it every day.
Yeah, it's really hard to not feel overwhelmed and bummed out about it. It gives me hope to know that other people are willing to do this in their free time for free. Like, it's gross hard work.
Oh, how seasonal. It's Halloween butter-flavored popcorn.
Larissa Gula from Carnegie has been volunteering with Allegheny Cleanways for about 3 years.
Litter cleanup is something that my mother was really passionate about. I guess we turn into our parents in the end.
In her can are broken CDs, takeout wrappers, and dozens of bits of plastic.
I think people act like litter shouldn't be a thing, but I also think that in reality, our system just is not designed to keep up with the amount of waste we produce.
Someone unearths the bottom half of a toilet.
Is it pink? Oh, it's so pretty. I'll take it.
25.5 pounds worth of toilet.
Steffis weighs a can with a blue plastic baseball bat sticking out of the top.
Sometimes household trash gets here because of evictions, so I don't really get too offended by people's personal behavior in regards to dumping sometimes, because I know there's obstacles that are causing it, especially like baby stuff, diapers, baby food, toys.
Danny Kramer says dumping happens when something is difficult or expensive to get rid of the right way.
It's free to dump on a hillside if you don't get caught. So I think there just need to be a lot more resources.
The 3-hour shift is just about over.
I'm done.
It looks so much better already. There you can like envision what it'll look like in the springtime. I mean, Pittsburgh's such a beautiful city, and every neighborhood has its own special hidden nooks and crannies, and everyone deserves to have a clean and beautiful place to live. So I think about it all the time.
The grand total for the day is just over a ton of garbage. The dumpster will be emptied at Pittsburgh's Department of Public Works. But the dump busters will be back again tomorrow to push further into the wooded area at the sides of the steps. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsoppel.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.